Good morning, and thanks to Banu and Bilgin and to the Kafke for inviting me here and for putting together this very interesting conference. This paper that I'm presenting now is a reflection of a large work in progress. The hard part was not writing the paper. The hard part was getting anywhere near the 12,000-word limit. So I apologize to anyone who made an attempt to read it, just because it is over the word limit, and I will try to keep within the time space in the presentation. This is the title, Reconstructing Europe, Community Identity and the Politics of Membership in the EEC. I like this image. It's an image I use in teaching all the time, just to get people to think critically about Europe and about the limits of Europe. Where does Europe begin and where does it end? If my students have given this any thought, the most standard answer is they say, well, it ends at the Bosphorus. That obviously doesn't refer to other potential geographic limits, but it's one answer to the question. And then I point to Cyprus and I say, well, if Europe ended at the Bosphorus, how does Cyprus qualify, or Iceland, or where I live right now, Ireland? So I like the image because it forces us to confront that question about where does Europe begin and end. Now, this is not, as you all know, you've thought about this as much as I have, this is not an easy question. And I'll illustrate this with a few brief quotations. First, the original Treaty of Rome, before it was amended, any European state may apply to become a member of the community. Well, the key word there is European, and as we know, it was undefined. Walter Hallstein, the first president of the European Commission, in Ankara in 1963, declared three times in the course of a two-page speech, Turkey is part of Europe. We're all familiar with Giscard's comment of just 9 years ago, Turkey is not a European country. And then this is my favorite one, from the foreign minister of Finland at the time, the acting EU president, who says, please don't ask me where its borders are. That's not a question we wanted to put on the agenda. So that very nicely captures the importance, but also the difficulty of this question. So what my paper tries to do is to, first of all, deepen this debate about the limits of Europe by providing some comparative historical perspective through some systematic theorizing and new empirical evidence, and to also to bring to scholarship on the early EU, as I said, improved understanding of identity building through regional integration. Regional integration was not just about building a common market and so forth, but it was also about identity building. And I do this by focusing on the one institution that aspires to integrate all the peoples and states of Europe, and obviously that is the EU. So the outline is a fairly standard one. I'll move very quickly through the project, the research question, the argument, methodology, findings, and conclusions. So first, the research question, which is much more specific than the opening question, where are the limits of Europe? But to make it tractable empirically, how does the European Union decide which applicant states are eligible for membership? That's the research question. The dependent variable here is critical episodes in membership decision making and how those episodes are resolved. Just to be clear, when I say eligible for membership, I'm not saying readiness to join. That's a separate question. And I'm not talking about the terms of accession, also a separate question. And the politics, particularly on readiness to join and terms of accession, those politics are very different. So that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about eligibility. The argument in very short terms, the argument is that EU decision-making on enlargement is explained by communal identity norms prevailing within EU institutions. Tomas over dinner last night was just telling me about his new book, which I haven't read yet, but I gather it makes somewhat of a similar argument, but looking more macro, more at a societal discourse and societal norms, perhaps. When I say norms here, just to be clear, I am not talking about formal rules. When I say communal identity norms, I'm talking about socially validated distinctions between us and them, between what is Europe and what is outside, that prioritize certain values and relationships above others. And when I say prevailing within EU institutions, I recognize these norms are inevitably multiple and contested, So I'm focusing on those which are dominant or most salient within the EU institutions. And I argue, borrowing obviously on Goldstein and Cohen, that these identity norms matter in two ways, in simple terms, as roadmaps and as hooks. First, I think we could agree that EU decision makers value regional integration, but in many cases are unclear on this question. They're unclear on the limits of Europe. So some of them may turn to these norms for a socially validated, for a legitimate definition of who is eligible to join. In the face of uncertainty, turn to norms for clarification. There's also a Hooke's argument that these norms tilt the playing field, if you will, in favor of applicants that fit the prevailing norm or that can be portrayed as such, and against those that don't. So these are the two ways that these norms can shape outcomes. The alternative explanations that the paper examines quite carefully, alternative explanations for how the EU decides on membership applications are, first, formal rules. That's the work reflected most clearly in Frank Schimmelpfennig's work. Geopolitical interests, reflected in the work of Lars Skalnes and others. And then two versions of a commercial interest argument, one a short-term, saying that member states would seek to defend sectoral interests, protect their share of the budget, and so forth, and then a longer-term commercial interest argument about gains from trade and expanded market. I pursue all this through multiple case studies, and I'm analyzing both the decision-making processes within each case. Who took what position and how did they justify it? What arguments did they make? But also comparing the outcomes across cases and across time. The case selection is looking at three Mediterranean states that applied to the EEC for association that was explicitly defined as association leading to full membership in the community. So three Mediterranean states, Greece, Turkey, and Spain. The first two of those I divide into subcases, which gives me five episodes. And the paper structures these cases to highlight variation in the explanatory factors and in the outcomes. The paper is based empirically on extensive archival work, or work in the archives of the Commission, the Council, the Parliament, three foreign ministries, and other archives, as well as press, interviews, and media sources. So that's how I've gone about this. Now, the findings, first of all, the paper divides the first 10 years of the European Economic Community into two normative periods, where I see a break in the salient norm within the EU institutions. So hence my period one and period two. As I say in the slide, the formal rule does not change in this period. Article 237 of the Treaty of Rome remains in place. It is not contested. It is certainly not changed. Article 237, any European state may apply to become a member. However, there is a change in the prevailing norm within the EU institutions. Between 1957, the signature of the Treaty of Rome, and the early winter of 1962, there is a clearly dominant norm within the institutions that the EEC is a community of non-communist Europe. That is the set of states and peoples who are considered potentially eligible to join. And all of the discourse within Council deliberations, within the Parliament, and so on, is framed in these terms when they're thinking about applicants. I look at two cases here. First, the Greek application, which was the first application for association, parentheses, leading to full membership. And I describe in the paper how that application was received and discussed within the Council, the Parliament, and other institutions. And it was clearly framed in terms of the community's desire to reach out to non-communist Europe and ensure the unity of non-communist Europe, culminating in the Athens Agreement in the summer of 1961. Turkey applied, I think, about 6 weeks later, very similar application, and the discussion is exactly the same. What's interesting is that Turkey, just as a contemporary footnote, the religious factor that is so salient today in discourse does not come up, is just not mentioned at all in any of the discussions. Also interesting is the fact that Turkey had a military government from May 1960 to October of 1961. This does not faze the decision makers at all. They occasionally say that discussions have been interrupted at the demand of the Turkish government. In other words, it doesn't bother us, but Ankara would prefer to delay for a little while. It's not discussed. Turkey is discussed as a prominent member of non-communist Europe, member of NATO, etc. That's the first period. The second period, again, the formal rule remains the same, but the norm has changed. The norm changed through basically policy entrepreneurship through members of the European Parliamentary Assembly. It's a fascinating story. I'm happy to talk about it in discussion, but I have to abbreviate it there. They managed through something called the Birkelbach Report in the winter of 1962 to change the discourse over the parameters, the legitimate parameters of the European political project. And they framed it, instead of non-communist Europe, they framed it as democratic Europe. Doesn't mean all the member states agreed with the Birkelbach Report, but the discourse changes dramatically in that period. So I look at here three cases. Spain lodged its application in the winter of 1962, and even though Paris and Bonn were strongly supportive of Franco's application, the application is rebuffed, and Spain is essentially told, go away and come back when you're democratic. The Turkish application continues. Fortunately for Ankara, Turkey had returned to democratic rule by this period, so the new norm that the community is a democratic community, that norm does not impinge on the Turkish application, and the application is concluded successfully in 1963 with the Ankara Agreement, as you know. And then Greece, which had signed an agreement in 1961, as you know, ta-da, April 1967, military takeover, and despite a very strong commitment among the member states to keep the project going, the project is ultimately frozen in the summer and autumn of 1967, and framed in this, and the decision to freeze it is framed in terms of this norm. So just a brief overview. Eva, do I have 2 minutes left?
Three,
okay. So here's a brief overview of the cases. I haven't had time to talk about the alternative explanations, but you see the math at the bottom. The early cases have contending explanations that all offer plausible, not just plausible, but explanations that find support in the evidence, in the archival evidence. But on the whole, the communal identity norms and the shift in identity norms in 1962 offers clearly the strongest explanation explaining all five cases. In fact, if we were to combine the two Turkish subcases into one, then it would be even stronger. The math would be even stronger. But in any case, here are the five, and the identity norms argument is clearly the strongest explanation. So, what conclusions do I draw from this? Well, first of all, returning to my first slide, the limits of Europe are not set by geography, but by an intersubjective consensus, which I call communal identity norms. These norms change over time. They do not eliminate the politics that emerges from divergent preferences. There's still a lot of divergent preferences over membership within the Union. But the existence of these norms structures the politics of those divergent preferences and thus has a significant impact on decision making. So despite the conventional wisdom that you hear in public discourse or in the academic discourse, formal rules, geopolitics, and commercial interests have limited explanatory power. And here I would just mention, because I love this quotation by Chris Hemmer and Peter Katzenstein, a region is not a geographic fact that has sociological consequences, but a sociological fact that takes geographic form. Now, they were talking about NATO and Asia, but that captures very nicely the European community. And unfortunately, I think this is bad news for Turkey, because this means that Turkey cannot qualify for membership on some simple glance at the map and a set of predictable policy reforms, because the definition of who is eligible is a moving target. And it is a moving target that is perhaps partly influenced by what Turkey says and does, but only partly. And that makes it hard, which is why poor Erdogan is so frustrated every time we see him speak about the EU. I'll leave it there. Thank you.